Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spangin. On today's show, listener, I never thought I'd find myself paraphrasing Frankie Goes to Hollywood on this show, but on today's episode, and in the aftermath of last week's dramatic announcement that Israel and the United Arab Emirates have reached an agreement to normalize relations, we'll be asking, peace, who is it good for? We'll also be asking whether Benjamin Netanyahu has now cleared his debt to President Trump and at the same time dealt a death blow to the peace camp. A little later on, we'll be dialing up Anshul Pfeffer in Jerusalem. But first, I'm delighted to welcome Haaretz's diplomatic correspondent, Noah Landau. Hey, Noah, how's tricks?
Hi, can you imagine I'm finally covering peace?
We shall see, as they say.
Exactly.
So, no, first things first, were you as surprised as Benny Gantz by Thursday's announcement? I mean, even though Israel and the UAE have enjoyed, you know, clandestine relations for years, this came out of nowhere, right?
Not exactly nowhere, and I don't want to get into all the details, but let's say I've been asking some people who did not exactly say the truth about this, but we'll save that, for a private discussion. In any case, of course that, you know, many people knew that there is a rapprochement in the air and that something is happening, and we had many clues, but in the end, this specific deal, as Jared Kushner said in a briefing to the press, was actually finalized in a few weeks. And the final details were finalized a day before the announcement. So I think everyone knew that something is happening between Israel and the Gulf in general, but not the exact timing and the specific deal.
So why now? What was the main catalyst for the announcement? And I'll give you a multiple choice format. Was it A, the presidential election in the United States, B, Netanyahu's trial, C, Iran, or D, all of the above?
Well, you know, of course, it's always all of the above with every issue. But I think in this specific case, there were two issues that I think were more important in the final trigger. And Iran is, of course, the first one. Mm. And I don't know if our listeners have been following what's happening now in the UN around the arms ban, the embargo on Iran. But this is something that is really concerns a lot also the Gulf and not only Israel. And even more so countries like the Emirates, because the kind of weapon that Iran might now buy without the embargo threatens them more than Israel even. So this is definitely, I think, one trigger. But the other one is annexation. Officials from the Emirates that I interviewed yesterday told me very clearly that they wanted to stop annexation. So it was a combination between the fact that they wanted to stop annexation, or at least if you're more cynical, you might say that they wanted to use that as an excuse to do something they wanted to do anyways. But that was definitely also a trigger.
The official you spoke to was Hendo Al-Otaiba, right? The Director of Strategic Communication at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Yes.
She also made it clear to you that her country is still calling for the establishment of a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. Is this just lip service?
Of course it's complicated. And, you know, other countries did not move their embassies to Jerusalem as well. You know, in the end, it was the U.S. and Guatemala, but not the entire world. So it's not only the Arab world who thinks that, you know, it's an issue. So, of course, it's a little bit more complicated. But again, if we have full diplomatic relations with other states that did not move their embassies to Jerusalem, why should they?
But she's going further. She's saying that the UAE will have an embassy in Jerusalem, but it'll be an embassy in the state of Palestine.
I'm not sure that's exactly her intention. I think what she says is basically what you can hear also from many European countries. We follow the international parameters, and we support the two-state solution with Jerusalem is capital of Palestine as well. So, these are the international parameters at this point. Mm.
The Palestinians are furious, right? But probably not surprised that their plight has been put even further on the back burner.
Many are. But again, everything is more complex and nuanced behind the scene. Officially, everyone says that, they were sold by the Arab world and so on. But also behind the scenes, some people are also not, the fact that the annexation is off the table for now or not for now, it's debatable. But the fact that right now annexation is off the table is not so bad for the PA as well.
Mm. The Palestinians are arguing that the UAE has effectively approved the Israeli occupation by saying we can have normalization and occupation at the same time, just not normalization and annexation. Are the Palestinians wrong on that, Noah?
Well, it depends how you look at it. I mean, it is true that before we had this annexation question, occupation was the issue. And now you could definitely argue that this means that Israel could have normalization and occupation. But on the other hand, Netanyahu argues that this was peace for peace, and it was not related to the Palestinian issue at all. But that is also not exactly true, because annexation was a condition, mm-hmm. and the Palestinian issue was a condition to this accord. So in the end, I think it was proven that the Palestinian issue is still a part of the conversation on regional peace, and it's not disconnected from it. And more than that, we're looking at the short term, but on the longer term, you can also argue that now that Israel brought in another player, to its home, it will have to also consider their opinion on many issues. Can you imagine that we will have an official UAE embassy, an ambassador in Tel Aviv, not in Jerusalem, but Israel will announce, something that is very controversial about Temple Mount or settlements and so on, and they will not have opinions about it? Of course they will. And they will also have more pressure from the Muslim world and Palestinians, because now the relations are not a secret anymore. Mm. So when you bring in another player, there are always two sides to the coin.
Mm. If we can talk about winners and losers in what we know isn't a zero-sum game, would it be fair to say that the main losers, other than perhaps the Palestinians, but that's arguable, are the ideological settlers? Their dreams of annexation, or they call it Israeli sovereignty over Judea and Samaria, if they haven't gone up in smoke, then they are very much on ice.
Well, I think they're divided on the issue from what I can tell. I think that, as we know, some of the settlers were not happy with Trump's peace plan at all. Mm. And they thought that annexing 30% of the West Bank in return for, recognizing the possibility of a Palestinian state is unthinkable. And they actually had a whole campaign against the plan and against annexation as part of the plan. So for them, taking this off the table is not such a big deal. Many of these people say, we have patience. I mean, they say, annexation is nice, but we wanted more. We wanted to annex 100%. Mm. So if it's not happening now, it will happen later. We have patience. That's, their side of the story. Others that are more, less ideological settlers and more Netanyahu supporters on the right wing would, argue that this was a good decision in realpolitik. Mm. In the end, annexation is nice, but this is more important.
For the business and security and communications elements that you've mentioned.
Yeah.
Listen, on last week's episode, Noah, Amir Tibon and I spoke about Netanyahu's debt to Trump. It now seems that Trump's going to be hosting the signing ceremony just weeks before the November 3rd election. Can Netanyahu consider his debt over Jerusalem and the Golan fully paid off?
I don't know if debts are ever paid off in those kinds of situations. But I think everyone except the Palestinians, as you said, have made a good deal. I mean, for Netanyahu, this is a great historical achievement that, you know, got many applause in Israel. I think very few people in Israel are against it or claim that it's, you know, more complicated. And for Trump, of course, you know, what's better than to show that he brought peace to the Middle East, even that's not the peace that we were looking after because we already had secret relations with countries in the Gulf. And, you know, the peace in the Middle East is supposed to be around Palestine. But, you know, why not celebrate the peace deal? It's positive for everyone. I saw that even Joe Biden had to congratulate it.
Wow, that's high praise coming from him. So the Nobel Prize is winging its way to the White House as we speak.
I wouldn't bet on it.
Are we wrong to be calling this a peace deal? I mean, you know, even when coronavirus travel restrictions are lifted, Israelis won't be flocking in their thousands to Dubai, right? And we won't have to get ready for a huge influx of tourists from Abu Dhabi.
Well, I mean, it's not peace in the sense that we had war before. Again, we had relations, we had secret relations with Gulf countries, but they existed. Israelis, you know, were traveling already to the region, and they had businesses, and there was a lot going on behind the scenes. So this is more, you know, what people call normalization, or, you know, just establishing full official diplomatic relations, which is not a good expression for titles, I know. peace sounds better. But, yes, why not? You could also call this peace, even though we weren't at war before.
Mm. And do we have a timetable?
Not really. We know that an Israeli delegation will probably fly this week to finalize details of the agreement, all the nitty-gritty details. And we also know that the White House wants to host an official ceremony in early September, in a few weeks. Mm. So it sounds like this will happen very quickly, but you never know.
Do you have your suitcase packed, Noah?
Well, yes, but again, it's not like I couldn't fly before. I think it's fun to see how Israelis are so excited about the opportunity to, you know, see Dubai. I think really the reactions are super positive, and you can see in the Israeli media stories about how much hotels in Dubai and Abu Dhabi cost. And, you know, they're interviewing hotel owners who are saying that they'll do a special price for Israelis. And it's really fun to see this.
They didn't say whether it would be a specially high price or low price, though.
No, they said it would be low. They actually said it. So it's really nice to see. But in the end, again, it's not that Israelis couldn't go before. And also, the main purpose is usually not tourism, but business. Mm. So I'm not sure this will be, you know, a major touristic attraction for Israelis, maybe the malls, I don't know. But I think this is much more about being able to have a much broader cooperation around security and around technology and business in general, more than tourism. Mm. Although for the other side, many have mentioned that in the UAE, that coming to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem would be for them very important and a great achievement.
Mm. Noah, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much, as always, for your time.
Thank you, Simon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Listener, we're going to play a quick jingle, and we'll be right back with Anshul Pfeffer. Welcome to part two, and welcome to Anshul Pfeffer. How are you, mate?
I'm good, Simon. How are you?
I can he like out, mate. Can he like out? Anshul, in my introduction, I paraphrased Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and I'm going to go even further now and quote another unlikely source, Henry Kissinger, who famously said that Israel has no foreign policy, only domestic politics. So let's talk about the domestic side of this diplomatic breakthrough. Shall we start with the exquisite hazing of Benny Gantz and Gabi Ashkenazi? Well played, BB.
Always a fun subject to torment Gantz and Ashkenazi.
They seem to be doing that well enough by themselves. They don't really need anybody's help, from what I can see.
I think Gantz and Ashkenazi are resigned to a less than inclusive role in this coalition for as long as it exists.
Second, third, and fourth fiddles. So talk us through Netanyahu's thought process, Anshul, from promising annexation to mothballing annexation and now to suspending annexation until God knows when. Apart from a temporary distraction, what does he gain?
Well, we have to remember annexation was, and until anything else happens with it, was an election promise. It was a triple election promise. He brought it up in different versions. Each of the three elections that he fought in the last year and a half, and like many election promises, especially the Netanyahu election promises, they remain sound bites that his opponents can replay, but He promised, but he didn't promise to fulfill.
Right. And you wrote back in May that there would be no annexation, right?
I always thought that annexation was, had too many contradictions within it. But certainly annexation, according to the Trump plan, which also included an Israeli acceptance of a Palestinian state, even if it was just an acceptance in principle, that was a bridge for too far for Netanyahu to cross with his right-wing colleagues. And also, I think he didn't really want to pay the price in any type of international furore over annexation, because that would have ruined his long-time goal of just gently pushing the Palestinian issue off the agenda. So if the status quo works well for him now, why push for annexation?
Mm. And he succeeded. I mean, 100% now, right? This is the annexation may be off the table, but pretty much so is the Palestinian issue.
I mean, we're dealing now with hypotheticals, but I think that whether or not the Emirati deal was on the table, Netanyahu would not have gone ahead with annexation. But it's as I said at the time, it's given him a great ball to throw up in the air and add to his juggling act. Now, you know, the annexation, yes, will he or won't he created this entire distraction from other issues, and now it's also given him a bargaining chip with which to push forward this Emirati deal.
Mm. What does this do to the domestic political scene, Anshul, for Netanyahu's, you know, rather ramshackle coalition?
I don't think it changes very much on the local political scene. Netanyahu's still facing the same problems he was facing before his three-way phone call with Donald Trump and MBZ. It's still very much a question of, can he somehow beat the rap on his corruption case, and how is he going to use his control of the coalition to try and reach that? Will he rush for an early election in the forlorn hope once again of trying to reach 61 MKs in the coalition who will vote to pass laws which will shield him from prosecution? He's already in court. The evidentiary stage begins in January, and Netanyahu's still trying to fight that in every possible way. And I don't see how this this agreement with the Emiratis changes that, because it doesn't really add more support on the right wing, because there are those on the right wing who believed in annexation and are angry at Netanyahu now for basically giving it up. So some of those votes will move to Naftali Bennett's Yamina. Some of those right-wingers may stay home if an election is called anytime soon. And though the centre-left is quite happy with the fact that Israel is going to have a normal or something close to normal relations with yet another Arab country, it won't make any centre or left-wing wing of votes in the upcoming election.
In a sense, it just highlights on the Israeli side what the priorities are. If making a peace deal with an Arab country doesn't sway voters, then it's back to the corruption, it's back to the coronavirus mishandling and the cost of living and all of the other issues that are bringing people still out to the streets.
And I think if we were in a different place in Netanyahu's political trajectory and very long career, this could have certainly helps him to win over voters from on the centre. But I think that right now, as much as people may be pleased with this deal, it's not going to divert their attention from the economic crisis, which is coming out as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, and the feeling, I think a justified feeling, that Netanyahu and his government have been very inept at handling that crisis, certainly in recent months. So I can't see that making much of a change. But Netanyahu will still be able to use this in his campaign, Netanyahu, even when we don't have an election date yet, Netanyahu is in a never-ending campaign to bolster his image as Israel's indispensable statesman. And that may give him a few points, and I think that, he certainly can claim to have achieved a diplomatic coup here. But I think that Israelis really are so entrenched in their views, whether they're for or against Netanyahu, that this really won't be a pivotal moment in local politics.
Mm. Does it make another election in the next few months more or less likely, in your opinion?
I think Netanyahu will probably feel that he has a better case for going to the public now, but it won't be his main consideration. It'll still be whether he thinks this is an opportune moment when it comes to gaining that elusive majority to shield him from prosecution. Mm. And does he think that the criticism of his handling of the pandemic will impact on his electoral prospects? It's certainly be something Netanyahu will talk up in the election when it happens, but I don't see this as changing his consideration to a great degree.
Mm. Would remain legal rather than ideological or political?
Legal and medical and economic.
Right. Mm. So what about the peace camp, Angel? As you pointed out, the Israeli left has warned for years that if we keep on ignoring the Palestinians, we'll never have peace with the Arab world. Bibi's proved them wrong.
I think so, and I think that this should have been clear already before the Emirati deal. Israel had faced so many verbal threats of what would happen if the unsustainable occupation continued, and lo and behold, 53 years in, the occupation still seems sustainable. It doesn't make it any more justifiable, or obviously you and I think that Israel should get out of the West Bank, or most of the West Bank, as soon as possible, and end the occupation. But that's not. But that wasn't the case which was being made. Well, Israel needs to do so, because if it doesn't do so, as Ehud Barak said at the time, it will face a diplomatic tsunami. And Ariel Sharon said that if Israel isn't proactive on this issue, it will be like a bull in the corrales and about to be slaughtered in a bullfighting ring. And Netanyahu seems to have, at least for now, proven them wrong. And as much as we still believe that the occupation is a bad thing, it should be ended. We need the Israeli peace camp, and people like you and me on the Israeli left, I think, need to come up with new and better arguments, because the old arguments Netanyahu has proved them.
Mm. He's replaced the two-state solution with the 27-state solution, you could say.
For now the UAE is just the third state, but that's already 50% more.
But then Oman is being invited
But I think the main thing here isn't simply the number of Arab states who will open up embassies in Tel Aviv. Obviously, they're not going to open them in Jerusalem. Mm. But it's the price that Israel is paying for the ongoing occupation, and that price is simply not a high price. It's a high price on a moral level, but it's not a high price on any other level. Israelis don't feel the fact that they're occupying another nation. I mean, yes, some Israelis serve in the army and the reserves and feel it through that. But by and large, the Israeli economy is not suffering from it. Israel's diplomatic standing is not suffering from it. And, if someone would have said a decade ago that Israel would have more diplomatic with more nations than ever, not just Arab and Muslim countries. Recently, there were meetings with Sudan and Chad, but also with nations in the Far East and in Africa. I mean, Israel is going through a period of flourishing of its diplomatic relations, and very little of this has anything to do with the Palestinian issue. Once upon a time, we had all these world leaders and foreign ministers and senior diplomats coming to Jerusalem and lecturing Israeli leaders on the importance of ending the Palestinian issue, of solving the Palestinian issue. And that doesn't happen anymore. There isn't that kind of pressure. Very rarely does Israel have to pay any type of diplomatic price, certainly not a real economic price. People talked about boycotts, as I predicted at the time. People thought it was serious. I said at the time that BDS is just online army of keyboard warriors, mainly based in London and other places in the West, not a real force against Israel. And I think that 15 years into the BDS campaign, we're seeing that as well. It's petered out, if it ever was anything, any real threat. And Israel's simply not paying a price for the occupation. So that's something that Netanyahu has proven over and over again. And the Emiratis are making this big deal out of the fact that they prevented annexation. I think annexation wouldn't have happened anyway. But it's very clear that there is at least an influential section in the Arab world who really want to put the Palestinian issue also on the back burner.
Will the international community, I mean, it's, as you say, it's fatigued from having told Israel over all of these years. Other priorities have come up now that will almost force them to sideline the Palestinians, right? I mean, Iran, as we're talking about with Noah, is a major factor here.
And you mentioned fatigue. I think there was a time when this was a big issue, it was a fashionable issue, and that time has passed. And there was this feeling of inevitability that, in the same way that apartheid ended, or the conflict in Northern Ireland, then the Israel-Palestine conflict would follow a similar course. But there are other injustices and occupations around the world which the world has sort of given up on. A good example would be the Free Tibet campaign, which was once a very popular campaign, and now nobody really pays much attention to the Chinese or longer ongoing Chinese occupation of Tibet. And I think the same can be said of a much more recent case in Crimea. The world sometimes acquiesces and gives up on causes. And with the exception of really a handful of news organizations in the West, and ironically some left-wing American Jewish organizations, you don't see this as a big issue anymore. I think Israelis are slightly paranoid about the amount of pressure on it. And once again, this doesn't mean that Israel shouldn't solve the issue. It just means that the pressure that people said that would come from the outside that would be unbearable, and Israel would have to face unbearable pressure to solve this issue, just isn't there anymore. And in that, Netanyahu has won. Now the question is, what does Israeli politics look like after that, and what does the center left in Israel do? But they have to acknowledge the fact that they can't simply carry on saying the world won't let us carry on with this, because the world has let us carry on with this.
And it doesn't look like the Israeli electorate is particularly interested in hearing any kind of message that involves the Palestinians or the occupation from any party.
I'd like to point out something interesting, that Yair Lapid and his Yesh Atid party still have the two-state solution in their platform. And they are even recently I spoke to some people in the party, and they were pained to point that out. So I said, okay, so what does that even mean? So we still think that it's something that has to be done. Is it at the top of their priority? It's certainly not. But I wouldn't say that this is not going to be an issue that Israeli politics is not going to deal with in the next few years. I think certainly when Netanyahu is off the stage, and perhaps when Abbas on the Palestinian side is no longer president, there'll be a re-engagement with these issues. But the parameters that we've always talked about seem to be very anachronistic now.
Anshul, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time and for your insights.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
Thank you too to Noah Landau and to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, salam from Tel Aviv.